I don't play games. I'm too busy
playing Battlefield 4.
Apart from Battlefield 4, which is not a game. It's a way of life. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, loyal fans, and first-time listeners, welcome to Season 1, Episode 11 of Bad Voltage. Now, this was originally slated to be a very special episode, and why I say that is, this was going to be our first ginger-free episode, as Stuart is currently moving, and he had a previous engagement, but Brian, I am a complete truant, Lunduke. was unable to join us at the very last minute, so X selflessly and, might I add, magnanimously, cleared his evening, is sitting around a bunch of empty boxes, and is joining Jono and myself for this episode, so we do appreciate that, X.
Yeah. I mean, once again, so Lunduke came back with, like, a ridiculous and, like, completely unbelievable excuse, and Ack, who's in the process of moving from one place to another, the only thing that exists in Ack's house right now is about 500 pies and a microphone, and Ack was able to join the show. So Lunduke, you deserve the kicking that you get, my friend.
No, absolutely.
So what are we going to talk about this episode, Ack?
Right, the first thing we can do, break down some bullshit. We're starting a new series of identifying things which are bullshit and then explaining why. So, in this one, we're going to talk about the Internet of Things.
Speaking about big visions of the future and what technology looks like, we have an interview with Tim O'Reilly. Now, this is a little bit different because Tim O'Reilly, who's the founder of O'Reilly Publishing and founded all the OSCON events and stuff like that, he has a very busy schedule, and it was difficult to kind of nail him down to a time when we could all join. So unfortunately, I had to do the interview by myself because the other guys couldn't join at that particular time. So, but we're going to get into a bunch of things about the future of the internet, about the NSA, and all kinds of stuff in that.
And inspired by one of the keynotes that Jono and I recently saw at Scale, we're going to talk about Lawrence Lessig and his anti-corruption efforts, mostly focusing on Congress.
Jeremy has a thing called the Whittings Smart Body Analyzer, which is basically incredibly expensive bathroom scales, and he's going to give us a review of them.
Isn't it Whittings?
Indeed it is. It was originally Wi-Fi Things, I think, and they just shortened it to Whittings.
It's not Whittings?
Okay, so...
it is spelled odd.
Right, so the Within GS WS50 Smart Body Analyzer. Get to hear all about it.
And then finally, we're going to have a Comunity recap, which is going to be covering all the cool stuff that's going on in the community, things like IRC channels and gaming servers and, you know, selfie contests and all kinds of stuff that's going on. We'll be filling you in. So,
and now, Bad Voltage.
A few weeks ago, Jeremy and I were at the SoCal Linux Expo in Los Angeles, and they had a surprise keynote speaker who was he did a talk on the evening in the form of Lawrence Lessig. Now, some of you who don't know who Lessig is,
hang on. It was actually Lawrence Lessig. It wasn't someone in the form of Lawrence Lessig, right?
It was indeed Lawrence
Lessig, yes.
It maybe looked very... Well, it was either him or someone who looked very, very similar to him. So anyway, he got up and gave this presentation. For those of you who don't know who he is, Lessig is he's like a Stanford law professor. He's very well known. He's a big activist when it comes to internet law and technology law and things such as that. He's the founder of the Creative Commons. He's written a bunch of books. He's quite possibly the best speaker that I've ever seen at a conference before. He's an unbelievable speaker. Yeah, remarkable. Anyway, he has turned his efforts recently to government corruption. So he announced his focus on this at something called the iCommons iSummit, which is the most ludicrous named event ever, in 2007. And he'd been criticizing this revolving door phenomenon in which legislators and staffers, they leave an office to become lobbyists and, you know, all the money that goes into that. He was offered the chance to run for Congress and he declined. He didn't want to do that. So what he did is he he joined up with this political consultant called Joe Trippi to found a project called Change Congress. Now, some of you will know Aaron Schwartz, who was an activist who sadly committed suicide, a few years ago now? And Lessig talked in his presentation about this very intimate conversation that he had with Aaron Schwartz about Schwartz was essentially challenging him, you know, how are you going to be successful with what you're trying to do here? And he used that kind of as his inspiration to organize this group called Root Strikers. And it's all about trying to get the money out of Washington and to stop government corruption. So he gave this big rah-rah kind of presentation at scale, and Jeremiah was stood at the back with a couple of beers watching it. And the question is, like, do we think this is actually going to happen? I mean, you know, it's a really nice thing for people to do, but yeah, let's be honest, right? We live in a pretty disappointing and kind of depressing political climate. Like, do we think that anything like that is even vaguely possible at striking at the root and solving the problem?
They certainly have a uphill battle and their work cut out for them. I mean, I think it's clear that almost everyone in the United States thinks that Congress is broken, right? Their job approval rating is something hovering a little over 10%, which you think would be appalling, but people just seem complacent with that.
They were probably pretty happy about that, right? It's better than we thought.
Astonishing that you could have 90% of the people think one of the three branches of government is doing a total terrible job, and yet nothing really happens. And the one stat that I actually didn't realize that was in Lessig's talk was that the average member of Congress spends somewhere between 30 and 70% of their time raising money for their next election. So if you're spending 70% of your time raising money, you're doing next to nothing for your actual constituents. So I would have thought it was bad, but I wouldn't have thought it was that bad. The other stat that I thought that was interesting is that they did a poll, and I'm always a little bit leery of polls because the way you word a question, really, you can get whatever answer you want out of it. But I thought the questions in this poll were worded fairly. And the end result was that 96% of people polled would like to see the influence of money decreased in Congress, but only 9% think that it's possible over the next few years. That's kind of why he started this, because he thought that kind of led to resignation, and that's why people aren't appalled that Congress's approval rating are 10%. And I guess I tend to agree with that. How you affect change given those numbers, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear here. You said they've got an uphill battle. Their battle is not up a hill, it's up Mount Everest, right? This
is right. And walking backwards with no shoes.
Well, exactly. but the important point here is that I think the US, as in so many other things, leads the world, specifically in corruption in government. But the influence of money is very, very obvious to US citizens and to people looking at the US Congress, at least partially because it is quite overt. Your stat there about spending 30 to 70% of time raising money in order to get re-elected, that doesn't happen in the UK because there are extremely strict limits on how much you're allowed to spend on things like an election campaign, precisely to avoid the problem you're describing. However, this is not to say that there is no government corruption in the UK. Yeah, in fact, to some extent, it may even be worse because it's all backroom handshakes that you never even get to hear about.
Yeah. I mean, don't you guys still have the House of Lords where it's just passed down? I guess you don't need campaign right finance reform and those kind of cases.
This is the point, right?
Go on, Ack. I know what your thoughts are on this.
No. We're not going to discuss the UK's bicameral system. Thank you very much. But the important point here is that it's hard to imagine the whole point of your elected House of Parliament, your elected House of Government, is precisely that they will make decisions which affect the country. Those decisions will almost always involve someone ending up with some money and someone not, you know. In that kind of environment, it's almost impossible to imagine how you can stop the people who might be in with a chance of money chucking some under the table back to congressmen, whether as an actual monetary kickback or in terms of offering them a job after they leave or just flying them around places to golf courses or whatever. I don't know how you can fix that. And given the fact that that's what government is, attempting to create a world in which people don't do that, to me seems like a hiding to nothing. All you can do is be as open about the fact that that's happening as possible.
He actually addressed that. He had a four-pronged approach to fixing it, and I don't know whether that would work. But his four prongs were publicly funded elections, political expenditures, which are always limited and always transparent, the end of the revolving door between Congress and K Street, which are lobbyists, and the reaffirmation that when the Declaration of Independence spoke of entities, quote unquote, endowed by their creator with unalienable rights, they were speaking of natural persons only and not corporations. So that's, he felt that given those four things, corruption would just end naturally.
But that's the thing, like, I mean, every one of those, I think probably the three of us would all, like, wholeheartedly agree with.
But it's not completely.
Well, but my point is that the gist of what he's saying is true, right? And the issues that he's raising is true. That the issue that I have to a degree with all of this is that it's very symbolic. Like, he talked in his presentation about there was Granny D, who's this old lady who walked from, I can't remember exactly where it was, somewhere in
New Hampshire. It was all the way across the country, right?
Oh, it was all across the country. That's right.
I believe so, yeah. They did New Hampshire, but she went all the way across the country.
She went across the country. And they, you know, to raise many of these issues. And so they're kind of doing a similar thing where they're walking from a place called Dixville Notch, which sounds like a 50s comic, down to Nashua in New Hampshire. It's like 185 miles. And they're doing this. This is the whole idea of the systematic corruption in Washington. And that, to me, I'll be honest with you, I think that's pointless, right? It's just, it's symbolic, and that's interesting, and it, you know, it'll get in the news and all the rest of it, but it'll be the 5-minute segment at the end of the news that's kind of the interesting thing of the day. I don't think that really changes.
I actually disagree with you on this one.
I don't agree with you either. Go, Jeremy.
For those of you unfamiliar with the New Hampshire, or how the American politics in general work, New Hampshire primary is the very first primary in the United States, and then therefore it has a vastly, vastly outsized impact on candidate positions, because that's the first time the polls really come out, so they pander to New Hampshire like you wouldn't believe. And I think the walks that they're doing to raise awareness, what his point, I think, and it makes sense, is if every person that comes up to one of those candidates asks, what are you going to do to end the system of corruption in Washington, which was his question, they're going to have to address it, and then that becomes one of their talking points. And once it becomes a talking point, it's on YouTube, it's on CNN, it's on Fox News, they then can't really go back on it. So Absolutely. It's a little bit more than symbolic.
What I think is interesting here is you can't fix this problem by just taking the existing laws, tweaking them a bit, passing a couple of extra laws that no one gets to hear about. The way of fixing the problem is by basically making everyone in the country care about it a bit. You have to have a massive groundswell uprising of people.
I get that.
The way you motivate 330 million people all at once is with symbolic gestures.
Right, and I agree with the value of symbolic gestures. What I don't think works as well is that specific symbolic gesture, right? So I think that specific means of raising awareness, I don't think it's effective. I agree with the idea of raising a groundswell of interest. The challenge for these kinds of things, from my mind, has always been, and I think this is particularly the case in the US, is there's loads of groups out there who are lobbying for rights. The people like the EFF, for example, in the technology world. There's all of these kinds of different groups, and the challenge is, like, if you are sympathetic to one of those particular messages, then you're very sympathetic to that group. The challenge is converting the message of that group into something that the wider demographic of people is going to be interested in, which is that change. I don't believe that walking from one part of New Hampshire to the other, A, is going to make that much of a difference to the people, to those candidates. Like, if people are asking the question over and over again, people ask questions about all kinds of stuff over and over again, and candidates don't have to care about it, particularly if they're driven by money. But B, I don't think it's going to bleed into the consciousness of the US that much. Maybe when they do it, it will. But the last what that they did, it didn't really get picked up on at all in the media.
Yeah, you have to do.
So I agree with symbolism, but I think it needs to be a wider set of symbolism, I guess.
Well, you need to do something slightly novelty to get media coverage on, you know, a platform that no one is currently listening to.
Right, but I don't know. I mean, it just seems like the thing I was very curious about when Lessig spoke was he talked a lot about the problem, and I think everyone in that room agreed with the problem. I mean, people more so than others, obviously. But the thing that got me was, I want to know what people specifically in that room can do to help. And I still don't have a particularly good idea of what that is.
He needs to avoid the EFF's big problem, in my opinion, is that they say there are all these problems and people listen to it and go, oh, blimey, those are serious problems. I'm glad the EFF is there to fix them for me.
Right.
He absolutely needs to not have people say, everything you're describing is a problem, Lawrence. Well done for setting up Change Congress. When you fixed it, I'll be really pleased. He needs to be seen as the figurehead of a massive movement rather than the group who's going to solve it
To be fair to him, he did at the end of the talk say, like, here's how you can get involved. But it wasn't clear to me. He basically said, you know, you people in this room, you're the future of technology. You're the people who need to have this fight. And I think he's right about that. People in that room have access to technology and social media, all that kind of stuff, to get the message out there. But it wasn't clear to me, and I'm in the business of growing communities, so I try to look ahead of these kinds of things. It wasn't clear to me how somebody actually gets involved. Maybe a good thing for us to do is to see if we can get him on the show, where he can lay this out, because I really love what he's doing. But
I think he does need more definitive, actual things that people can do.
Right.
Aside from if you live in New Hampshire and want to take a walk.
Right. Because we're all pragmatists, right? Yep. Well, you are now, Ack, since you stopped being a free software hippie.
As I mentioned in the Season 1, Episode 4 Open Source Health segment, I'm someone who makes a concerted effort to stay relatively healthy. Now, part of that means exercising regularly and being cognizant of my eating habits, but as an open source tech guy, I'm someone who prefers to make empirical decisions. I like data. I like being able to spot trends, and from there see if I can find causation. Unfortunately, I'm not dedicated enough to regularly weigh myself, write it down manually, and then start graphing that data. Enter the WhyThings WS50 Smart Body Analyzer, which is an internet-connected smart scale, meaning it's part of the much-ballyhooed Internet of Things. A few seconds after stepping on the scale, you'll know your body weight, BMI, fat-lean ratio, and heart rate. It even tracks air quality, carbon dioxide levels, and temperature. That's just the beginning, though. Moments later, all the data is synced and available online in the HealthMate dashboard. From that dashboard, you can view a variety of graphs and trends, see how you're progressing toward goals that you've set, and see how you compare to normal ranges for your body type. You can also access the data via both iOS and Android apps. Armed with this data, it's easy to spot that your recent trip to Los Angeles for scale may have caused you to put on a pound or two, or that giving up a certain product after a certain date actually has paid dividends. If you need a bit of an extra motivator, or you're just the attention-seeking type, you can even automatically post your data to Facebook and Twitter. The scale supports multiple users, identifying different users by weight, with a clever system for choosing between users with similar weights. If that's all you use the Smart Body Analyzer for, I'd already consider it an extremely useful device, especially if it actually motivates you to adhere to the fitness goals that you've set for yourself. But once you're using the HealthMate dashboard, you'll find that it also integrates with other WhyThings products. Add the Pulse Activity Tracker, for example, and you'll get sleep cycle analysis along with steps taken, calories burned, elevation climbed, and distance traveled throughout the day. Additional data sources aren't locked into WhyThings products, however. With over 100 supported third-party apps, you can add information from RunKeeper, MyFitnessPal, the Fitbit, and many other items. This allows you to form a fairly comprehensive view of your overall life. So, what's the bad voltage verdict? The WhyThings WS50 Smart Body Analyzer is a great way to track and monitor a large number of health-related metrics. While expensive for a scale, in my opinion, the $150 is a small price to pay for a device that's easy to set up, easy to use on a daily basis, and provides such a plethora of health-related data.
I think the thing which most terrifies me about the idea of a smart body analyzer is that I'd step on it and it'd look at my body and go, yeah, not very smart.
But it's just like, give up.
There is a ginger alert in the dashboard, so you'll be fine.
Seriously, I mean, on the one hand, I hear what you're saying. I understand the theory and everything. On the other hand, it's some scales which cost $150. Why didn't you just buy 150 sets of ordinary bathroom scales?
Like I said, I admit it is for a scale. If you're just going to use it again as a scale, it's a little bit pricey. But for what you get, I think the amount of use that I've gotten out of it, I would consider it not a terrible deal if you have the money to spend.
The so I have one of the Fitbit Aria scales,
which is similar,
which is the same basic principle. And I think the notion of tracking body metrics so you can keep an eye on things is an interesting one. Like, because I think that there's two types of people here, right? There's people like you, Jeremy, and then there's people like me and Ak, right? You just naturally work out and you know it's important and you feel like your body like feels an urge to do that. Ak and I, we ain't built from that kind of material.
No. I feel well, the same
I didn't for a very long time. It's more of a recent thing for myself.
Oh, really?
I feel okay. Much the same way as Jeremy, just about sandwiches rather than jogging.
So, you know, I think having that kind of notion of keeping an eye on what you're doing is interesting. Like Erica saw this campaign yesterday. It's a Kickstarter. They've already reached the amount for a band that you wear that tracks the glucose on your skin, and it can tell you how many calories that you've consumed or you've burnt. And it's just another number that you can use, because I think you typically, when you're working out, you want to know how many steps am I doing, you know, how much weight am I losing, and how many calories am I consuming. So yeah. Like those three combinations, actually, I think is pretty nice for
track your
out
glycemic you index and all this kind of thing. I mean, I must confess, much as I want to mock this thing so hard that I need to take a run up, right? I have a Nintendo Wii, and with that, I have Wii Fit.
I exercise.
Yeah, with that, I have Wii Fit.
And so you're on the balance board.
Wii Fit does exactly this, right? They've been doing it for years. You've got the balance board, you stand on it, it weighs you, it tells you whether your balance is right, works out your BMI, all that stuff. They've been doing it for it. So as more and more of these devices come on the market, it's great. One of the things that I wanted to ask about, the impression I have with this thing is it takes measurements, it then uploads them through a thing you don't get to know about to the servers run by the people who sold you it, and then they graciously maybe let you download a CSV file or something. This means to me two things. The first one is, if the company goes bust, your 150 quid scale is pointless. And secondly, we've talked elsewhere in the show about the Internet of Things and the idea of an open protocol and something. Almost everything that's in this kind of healthcare monitoring market seems to be, you know, the idea of reporting the data electronically sounds brilliant, but it's all very much tied to servers run by the company you got it from, who then graciously give you access to your data if you're lucky. And is that a problem?
Yeah. As with every cloud-related service,
as a problem.
Yes, that's always a concern. With this particular one, you can sync it directly to your phone without going to their servers. The dashboard on the phone is not quite as interesting as the online one. You probably get 85, if I had to guess, percentage of the functionality. So even if they went out of business, the last version of the app, if you had it on your phone, you'd still get some of the utility, not all the utility. And you can export it right from your phone to the other things. So if you do use the MyFitnessPal, you can go right from the phone to that. Admittedly, if they go out of business, then you do lose a fair amount of the functionality. Yeah. But I think that's, unfortunately, the case with many things these days that I use Google Reader and Google didn't go out of business and I'm still screwed. So
yeah, I mean, it does worry
use
me
cloud
slightly
services
that,
at your peril.
You know, 3 years from now, if you're still using the thing, you end up going and finding lib incredibly expensive scale on GitHub and trying to compile it just in order you can use the thing that you bought. And there's no
outcry
from the open source community about this sort of thing, which surprises me slightly.
It surprises me too, actually.
Really? The open source community doesn't exercise. That's the reason why there's no outcry.
but they're quite happy to shout about stuff which is not actually relevant to them, as long as there's a reason to shout about it.
That was maybe a little harsh, I accept. For the Fitbit, they don't have a Linux client for syncing. You see, your Fitbit can sync wirelessly, and it's basically over Bluetooth. So you have there's a Mac client and a Windows client, and it's remarkably like locked down and encrypted, and you know it's difficult to be able to get data out of it. But people are building clients, you know.
Right.
But
one of the questions I wanted to ask
whole world,
Jeremy,
people,
not about the. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, I think the thing is that whole world people who consume those products probably don't really care about the fact that, yeah, it'll go away. It's like buying, you know, Battlefield 4. At some point, they're going to switch off the multiplayer game servers and you'll be able to play the game anymore, you know?
Yeah, no, true. I mean, a question I have about the specific thing, rather than talking generically about kind of healthcare monetary stuff, these specific scales, what led you to them rather than any one of the 30 other products which do this? What's good about this specific one?
It seemed that there was three that were popular, and one, Jono has one of the other ones. The reviews of this one seemed the best. They're all pretty similarly priced. The online dashboard for this one seemed significantly better than the rest of them. It did a little bit more data, and the integration with third party. So I actually use Runkeeper when I run. So the integration with Runkeeper was one of the things that really led me towards this one.
Yeah, that's going to be helpful. Of the other ones. If you're into this stuff, you'll be using Runkeeper, or you'll be using Moves, or you'll be using a Fitbit or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, but Withings is pretty well known. Like, you see it support for it in a bunch of different apps. What about the whole? So before I got the Fitbit Aria scale, I bought another one which, you know, detects your body fat and all that kind of stuff. And it's a number that I just completely lack any faith in. It just sounds like a made up number where it detects, you know, it sends little electrical impulses through your body and it figures out your body fat index or something. Do you think that is useful on that thing?
As far as accuracy goes, I'm sure it's not. I'm sure it's accurate within one or two orders of magnitude, aka not very accurate. But I think as far as spotting trends within yourself, it's probably accurate enough to be useful. I wouldn't use that. I would not put any faith in that discrete number. No.
Right. And I forget from the interview, from the review, but the badges and stuff like that you can get, I'm assuming, you know, for achieving.
If they have badges, I paid no attention to that stuff.
Oh, because like on Fitbit, there's things like you get a badge when you get 10,000 steps. And you know, if you lose like a pound, you get your first badge and whatever else. I wasn't sure if that, because that stuff actually works for a lot of people, I think. So.
Yeah, I'm not in the demographic that cares. I got one badge when I got in. It was just a You Are Awesome badge, and I haven't paid attention since.
Makes me want to make a sick in my mouth, that badge.
There is, it has to be said, an awful lot of bullshit out there on the internet. So, as a public service, we at Bad Voltage...
You're going to stop speaking?
...are going to do our level best. Jono is going to stop speaking. Jeremy and I will discuss some of the bullshit. Specifically, this time we're going to talk about the Internet of Things. Now, there's an awful, as I said, there's an awful lot of bullshit out there, right? And there are only... three of us, sometimes four of us. So it's going to take us a while, but we'll get started. The Internet of Things, break down the bullshit. Go.
We should first of all talk about what it is, right?
It's bullshit, won't know what it is.
Some people won't know. So the Internet of Things, so everybody is intimately aware of what this is. It's been rambled about quite significantly recently.
Assiduously over the last couple of years. Yeah.
It basically means everything in your office right now, or your student dorm, or whatever it might be, whether it's your computers, whether it's your keys, or your eyeglasses, or your remote controls, or your wallet, or anything, is connected to the internet. So it's connected in the sense of things can talk to each other, data can flow, but also they can kind of come together to do interesting things. So an organization, for example, may... have sensors on some of its factory devices that can make sure that, you know, when you run out of a particular material, it's automatically ordered, or that you don't waste paper or whatever it might be. There's all kinds of different ways in which it connects together in interesting ways.
Yeah, so. There's a bunch of high level, kind of trivial, obvious uses of it, like your fridge knows when you're running out of mayonnaise and then it reorders it for you and so on. People like Bruce Sterling have been talking about SPIMES for years, the idea of... an internet created or a representation of an object living on the internet. And it's not just about gluing RFID tags to everything in the world, but you do get the impression that that's going to be stage one.
Right. Now, it seems like there's a few different bits of this, right? So first of all, is it bullshit in the sense of it's a nice idea, but it's never going to happen? And then the second bit is it bullshit in terms of, are there risks attached with this? Because, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, what about the privacy and safety concerns and stuff like that? And then also, is it bullshit in the sense of, will it be an open thing? Or is it going to be a big proprietary network of things that connect together?
Well, I think it's by definition an open network, right? Because they're using the internet. So that I think that one's kind of already being answered. How things attached to the main hub might be it Z-Wave or RFID or NFCs, most of those are still open. But the main point being an Internet of Things, it has to be on the internet, which is an open network.
Nah, you can chuck an awful lot of proprietary stuff over the internet. I point you out, Netflix, 40% of internet bandwidth. 40% of this whole beautiful open internet of ours is a carrier medium for something which is not open at all and is owned by one company.
You can access it via open standards, though, right? You're still accessing it via TCP/IP.
Yeah, but the shit that you send over TCP/IP may be massively proprietary, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Right. Although you'd think that the Internet of Things can't be successful unless everything can talk to everything. That's the whole point, right?
Well, you see, but this is, again, going to be one of those things like mobile phone standards or floppy disks or whatever, where there'll be 25 companies trying to do it, and every one of them will be attempting to make sure that they are the founders of the technology, because someone somewhere will have sat in a boardroom and said, hey, with the Internet of Things, every single thing that exists will have a tag on it, and everyone will have to buy one of those tags off of us for a penny.
Right? I think home automation might turn out to be the microcosm of the Internet of Things, right? When home automation first started, there was Z-Wave and Zigbee, and some were Wi-Fi, some were completely proprietary. And as things kind of went on, usually you end up with one.
Yeah, and what happens is 5 years after everyone started to battle it out, half the companies who tried to do it have gone bankrupt. And the other half say, okay, we've all got 6% of the market. We take up between us 30% of the market. And there's another 70% which no one is doing because no one are going near us because there are too many standards. Let's get together and make X10 or GSM or whatever, and then they all reluctantly cooperate. What I'd like to be able to do is say, okay, Internet of Things, skip over the 5 years of bullshit and fighting at the beginning. I just don't know how
that's not going to happen, though, is it?
No, exactly. I mean, that's
seems
how
I'd like to fly to the moon on a carrot, and that's not going to happen as well.
taking the capital,
I'd like to go to Mars on the Mars One project, but probably not.
Yeah, that's even less likely.
if you are inclined towards this sort of thing rather than away from it like I am, then you would say this is how good standards get thrashed out, which is not a totally unreasonable point of view.
Right. Now, the XMPP Standards Foundation are apparently creating a framework for this, for a fully open standard. That's not tied to a specific company. I think they're calling it the Chatty Things Initiative, which is the worst name for any kind of standard. That sounds like a game on like one of those 3D handheld Nintendo consoles.
Well, yeah, but the flip side is if they say, okay, it's RFC 19103 compliant, no one's going to use it, are they? You've got to have a name for stuff.
I didn't realize that there was branding considerations when it comes to boring standards. Do you guys know anything about that? I mean, is that actually going anywhere? I don't know what layer that is. Is that, I'm assuming that's just for the core layer of something connecting to something else.
That's the communication layer stuff. I mean, I think
right.
As usual with these things, just putting a standard out there and saying everyone should start using this tends not to have a great deal of take-up, right? You need someone to put some money behind it, some funding behind it, and start pushing. Anyone who's going to do that expects to get a return on investment by owning a load of the market. But it would be nice to think that anyone attempting to adopt this doesn't think, okay, we'll invent our own thing, which is our own thing right down to ground level. They just say, okay, what we can do is take Chatty Things and rebrand it. I think that's the hope.
But to me, it seems like the only way in which this can work, it's kind of like USB adoption, right? The USB standard, USB is in basically everything. If anything has a connector and data's got to flow over it, it usually uses USB. And, you know, the USB standards authority, or whatever they're called, have done a really good job making sure that any device can do that, and it doesn't cost a fortune for them to implement that into it. It seems to me like, for example, if Facebook wanted to control all of this, it's going to fundamentally limit the Internet of Things, because you're not going to want to have one organization control it. So the only way it can work is through some kind of standards foundation, and maybe maybe that's it, you know.
But yeah, I mean, what we have out there at the moment, as you say, the XMPP people have put together essentially a protocol. They've defined the TCP/IP of the Internet of Things. Obviously, it will run on top of TCP/IP, but you know what I mean. They're defining the protocol on which things will chat. What they're not doing is actually making chatty things. That needs someone to go out there and do it, It needs lots of people to go out there and do it. If they all get on board with using chatty things and don't extend it in their own way, then you'll be able to have a bunch of stuff which all talks to one another. Now, from our point of view, that's obviously brilliant. So any company who's got funding to do this stuff is going to want you to buy a fridge and mayonnaise from them or from one of their partners or whatever. They don't want something which is universally applicable, because then you've got no reason to go with one company rather than another.
Now, I think one thing that relates to this that a lot of our listeners will be interested in is that privacy and safety consideration here. Like, if I was watching the Daily Show last night, there was a guy in there who's written a book about generational shifts, and he was talking about like the millennials generation and Generation X and Generation Y and how they differ. You know, like kids today, for example, have always grown up with the internet. The internet's always been around for them, and that generation is shifting a little bit as we went from the internet of old, which was just, you know, when those kids were young, they were using the internet primarily to browse websites and play some simple games. And now it's the whole social media and privacy issues and all the rest of it, as well as the concerns that people have about spying and whatever else. But magnifying that to everything is connected, like, it makes me wonder how psychologically people are going to be able to deal with this kind of stuff. Because how are people going to react when they're not plugged in, you know? Like, first, like, it seems like today people have got to have a very strong understanding of how to manage their private lives with this technology. It's not simple. It's not as simple as just not using a service or switching off the privacy settings or whatever. It's it's just complex in those areas. But you know, I sound like a tinfoil hat guy when I talk about this kind of stuff. You know, because it's going to happen, but how do we think this is going to happen in a safe manner? Because what worries me is that with the increase in cybercrime as well, that this means that people can hack all kinds of different things.
I think there's going to be profound security and privacy challenges both. If everything is connected, then I think, I don't know how you get security or privacy out of that scenario.
Here's the important point, right? It would be the way these things tend to work is some company or whatever builds a thing, lots of other people clone it, we end up with an evolved standard, and at that point people start saying, oh, I wish they baked privacy into the protocol, right? With the Internet of Things, we have the opportunity to do that. If you're the sort of person who 5 years from now will be saying you shouldn't buy any of these products because they violate your privacy, instead of just railing against the concept, get involved with XSF and say, okay, how can we, you know, we want this protocol to underlie everything. How can we make sure that it does enforce the privacy and security guarantees that we will want to see in the Internet of Things?
And you'd imagine that, you know, this is going to be a pretty strong consideration. I mean, they're building this protocol within today's culture of the internet, right? And issues with privacy are not a new thing. They've been around for a while. So I'd imagine, cutting them a bit of slack, that they're going to consider this. Even if they build, I guess the thing is, the system level kind of safety and privacy, and then there is user level. And it's the user level thing that worries me a little bit more, because it's not like you only have to care about your information and your usage of a website anymore. It's everything is connected. And we talked about this in Log Radio one time, that, you know, back in the early day, you've been able to find out, for example, information about where crimes are committed for years. And they put that information on the internet. But then that combined with mapping meant that you could find out, you know, if there were criminals in your local area. There was a thing in England where paedophiles and people on the sex offenders list were added, were mapped out. And then people were going around like stringing up their neighbors and accusing them of all kinds of stuff. So I guess it's the combination of devices connected and data connect and different visualizations of the data. I think that's where things are going to get a little nerve wracking. But that sounds like it's just the evolution of technology. There's basically no
way. Right, I was going to say, once everything is connected, I think the baseline for privacy would be above what I consider acceptable now. But I don't think there's any way around that.
Yeah, it's just.
I think it's going to be a baseline thing, right?
At that point, if you are opposed to the very concept of that data existing at all, even given a whole bunch of privacy and security and safety guarantees baked into the technology, if your objection is to the concept of there being databases of that sort of data, then all you can do is say the Internet of Things is a terrible idea and we shouldn't do it, and that's it. And I believe the universe is going to go against you on this.
Well, and the thing is as well...
Oh, you're fighting a rising tide on that one. Yeah, there's no way.
Yeah.
This is probably just a generational shift as well, because, you know, kids born today will be growing up with the Internet of Things. So they will they'll intrinsically know how to manage that technology, like, yes, in terms of their use of it, I'd imagine so. So wrapping things up then, in terms of is it bullshit or not, what do you guys think? Ack, do you think it's bullshit, taking all these considerations into account?
It feels a bit too much like a solution in search of a problem. I think the Internet of Things is not a thing which gets created. It's a name that you give to the universe 20 years from now when this has all happened, and then we go, okay, we need a way of describing that change, and then so we call it the Internet of Things. But people shouldn't be sitting down trying to create the Internet of Things. Just let it evolve.
The metaverse. Jeremy, what do you think?
Well, I think the name, the Internet of Things, is kind of stupid and so nebulous of a concept that I think the term is bullshit, but I think the concept of what it will enable, from smart parking to, you know, smart road tolls to connected defense devices to home automation, and even, like you mentioned, urban infrastructure, things like smart electricity grids and smart water systems, I think we are inexorably moving to that being a normalcy, to that being just expected, right? I think right now you think in concepts of, I'm going to go online and look something up. And I think in the future, you'll just be online. You won't even think that you have to go online. It'll just be there. So the concept is not bullshit. The term,
And what do you think? I think the thing is that with things that have happened over the years, new stuff gets a name and it gets talked about a lot, and cynical arseholes such as us think it sounds like bullshit. So yeah, I remember having similar conversations about like Web 2.0, stuff like that, right? But I agree with you, Jeremy, like the name is bullshit, but the principle and the concept, I think, is really valuable. And it could actually open the door to all kinds of cool stuff if we let it. So on the show right now, I'm delighted to bring on Tim O'Reilly. Now, many of you will know Tim as the founder of O'Reilly Media, but Tim is also seen as very much a forward-thinking mind on technology and obviously an activist as well. So, Tim, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Brilliant. Well,
lots of interesting things going on these days.
you're not kidding. So, you know, I just want to kick off first of all with the publishing side of things. Obviously, many people know you from O'Reilly. A lot of people who listen to the show, big fans of O'Reilly and the books that you guys produce. How are you seeing the publishing industry changing? Because a lot of people have concerns about, you know, people often talking apocalyptic ways about the death of print media, but O'Reilly is very invested in online media and other pieces as well. What's your views on that these days?
Well, first off, I do think there are a number of deep changes in how people consume information that, you know, we have traditionally published books about. Right. You know, the first change is that, which has happened years and years ago, is that there was a whole class of reference material that just kind of migrated online.
Right.
Yeah, there's also this huge change in the you know, disappearance of, you know, print bookstores. But the demand for information is still there. We still sell, you know, pretty much close to the number of books that we used to sell. It's
right.
Much more widely distributed. We sell a lot more long tail titles. There's no giant bestsellers in the way that there used to be. A huge part of the expansion has been driven by ebooks.
Right.
You know, we sell ebooks direct from O'Reilly.com. That's our largest ebook channel. One big expansion is that our books are available all over the world in places that we never sold a single print book.
Right, right.
So, you know, people will buy ebooks in Azerbaijan. You know, they never saw an O'Reilly book in a store in Azerbaijan.
Right.
You know, so that's one of the things. You know, and committing to DRM-free, has been a huge advantage to us there. It makes it much easier.
So
also gives us a differentiator against people like Amazon.
So let's dip into that for just a second, because I think a lot of people don't realize that O'Reilly books are DRM free. And, you know, so for example, with my book, The Art of Community, I remember when we had the conversation about it being available under a Creative Commons license as well. It was a complete no-brainer for O'Reilly. So a Creative Commons licensed book that isn't protected by DRM, a lot of people would say that that's crazy business logic. What's your view on that?
Well, first off, I do think that people understand that if authors and publishers don't get paid, they won't keep doing what they do.
Right.
So most people are willing to pay. Secondly, yeah, I wrote a piece back in 2002 called Piracy is Progressive Taxation. The premise was, if you're super popular, yes, you probably will lose some sales to what, you know, is called piracy.
Right.
But if you're not very well known, free gives you a lot more opportunities for exposure. Now, again, O'Reilly books are not put out freely on the net.
Yep.
You know, when we say DRM free, we mean we sell it to you, we trust you. That's a different message than,
right,
hey, we're giving this away and hoping that we'll pick up some sales along the way.
Right.
I mean, there are some books that we publish that way. But mostly it's like, you know, we know that, you know, that you're basically not planning to, you know, take these books from us. And the people who would probably wouldn't pay us anyway.
Right.
You know, and that was true even in print, that was true. We would get back, you know, huge, you know, truckloads of books from Barnes & Noble and Borders in the day, and they were stickered, and we couldn't resell them. What did we do? We sent them off to Africa. We figured, hell, there's people there who are never going to pay us, but they can use this stuff. Yeah, we still do that. We're a group called the Network Startup Resource Center out of the University of Oregon.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly from my personal experience. I mean, people are buying my book, and it's been available. You know, it's pretty well known that it's available to download. So I certainly personally agree. So shifting gears a little bit, you know, we said at the beginning of this interview, you know, we're in a period of interesting times right now. You know, Facebook IPO'd for, I think it was $104 billion. WhatsApp, there's the whole $19 billion sale to Facebook. The internet is where things are happening right now. What's your view on this? I mean, it strikes me that we're in a bubble, very crisply in a bubble. What's your take on what's happening with all these enormous sales for arguably with companies with very little kind of revenue flow?
Well, I would actually disagree with the bubble formulation. Yes, I think there's a lot of capital chasing stupid ideas. So there's a bit of an investment bubble. But you know, if you look at Facebook, they have actually done a tremendous job monetizing. And they're making an acquisition like WhatsApp is incredibly strategic for them. They're like, whoa, you know, if we don't, we may be toast because WhatsApp may be the next Facebook.
Right.
They have an expansive stock. They're basically buying, you know, half a billion users from a very fast-growing application. And they've demonstrated the ability to use advertising to monetize those users. So, you know, my guess is it'll be looked back on like the Google purchase of YouTube, which everybody was shocked at the time, even though it was a much smaller,
right,
you know, purchase. And it'll go, whoa, that was, you know, pretty damn smart.
But do you think I think people understand the value, but then we hear this figure of $19 billion. I think that's the delta that a lot of people have with this. How do you kind of map that figure?
I think people have that reaction partly because it happened so fast,
right,
and to such a small group. And that's a testament of how fast it was possible for them to grow that user base. I guess I think it's, you know, you may look back and go, wow, that was rich, but they may look back and say, no, actually, that was pretty smart.
Right.
And I'm sure there was some element of, you know, bidding war. I think there was some, you know, they were trying to keep it out of Google's hands, was it?
Right.
But, you know, and then you look at other companies, there's a lot of these companies with pretty meaningful revenue, Uber, Airbnb, you know, real revenue generators. So unlike the dot-com bubble, when you had a huge number of companies with incredibly high valuations and no revenue,
yeah,
you know, you either have, you know, companies with high valuations and meaningful revenues, or huge user bases being acquired by companies that actually do know how to monetize. Now, you know, it's certainly possible, you know, you look at Twitter, does it really justify its valuation? I mean, Facebook clearly has.
Right.
You
know? Right, right.
They figured out how to make money. They figured out how to make money on mobile.
Right.
I think it's probably, you know, we'll look back and we'll say, yeah, there were a lot of dumb deals, but there were a lot of smart ones too.
Now, you've talked a lot in the past, many of our listeners will be familiar with this, about your notion of the internet operating system. You've talked about how the internet is, you know, consisting of various subsystems, payments, media, things like that,
is going to be
driving much of our technology forward. How do you see things like Facebook and Twitter and WhatsApp? I mean, these are arguably key pieces of plumbing for how people collaborate together and how people communicate together that are owned by these organizations. What's your view in terms of like maintaining those pipelines to make sure that people can continue to collaborate and communicate with each other?
Yeah, you know, I don't know how it's all going to play out, because you do have a bunch of rival models. You know, there's the original internet model, which websites and web services were all interoperable. And even though you have somebody like Google, who had a very dominant app, it still played by the same rules, and you could have somebody else who had a different app. And the battle was along this one axis. Would, for example, Google, start pointing to itself rather than to Yelp for, right, you know, restaurant recommendations, whatever. But you could kind of see that everybody was playing the same game. And now you kind of have a set of worlds that only partly overlap. You know, yes, there is a web internet world of, Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, but there's also sort of a private network running on top of the internet, in some cases running apart from the internet using, you know,
right,
purely mobile technology. And so it's a little bit more complicated. And then, of course, you have the battle of the two big mobile ecosystems, Android and iPhone. But the key insight, you know, when I said internet operating system, there were several pieces. First of all, it's a notion. It's not, strictly speaking, an operating system,
right, right,
in the way we used to think of one. But then again, neither was Windows. You know, Windows was... You know, just simply a windowing layer on top of DOS, which was the real operating,
right,
system,
exactly,
for many, many years. And yet, eventually, you know, all those outer layers really do become kind of the equivalent of an operating system. And you see this, for example, the way that Amazon Web Services, you go, well, wait a minute, that's clearly, you know, this storage, this computation, this, you go... you know, and then certainly the data layers, you go, well, if people are looking for location, there's a couple of alternatives for location data that you can look at, you know, Facebook and Twitter and, Google Plus as alternate sources of identity.
Right.
You know, so that you can think of it notionally as subsystems. But, one of those key, you know, notions that I had was that these are data subsystems. And that we need to start thinking about not just software, you know, and the idea that the role of an operating system is to connect applications to hardware and you know, system software services, but to connect to data sources.
Right.
And
right.
That, I think, you know, and particularly data sources that are not on a single device. And that, of course, is, I think, a fundamental metaphor and a fundamental way of thinking about the world today. And you look at an application like, say, Uber, it's a classic example of what Dave Stutz many years ago called software above the level of a single device.
Right.
You know, there's an app in the driver's car. There's an app in the passenger's hand. There's a database back end that's sort of tracking location of both of those people in real time. There's a payment subsystem, which has stored credentials and lookup. There's a communication subsystem that allows you to communicate anonymously with the driver, and none of this stuff is sitting there, you know, in the app on your phone. So, well, if it isn't an internet operating system, where is all that stuff living?
Well, it kind of that kind of neatly segues a little bit onto something I wanted to ask you about, was, you know, the big buzzword that everybody's talking right now is the Internet of Things. The idea that all of the things around us are intrinsically connected. And on one hand, it makes perfect sense. We've got the infrastructure, we've got the technology to be able to do this. But then on the other hand, we've got a growing trend towards you know, key pieces of infrastructure and how people communicate and how people connect together. Things such as Facebook and things such as Google. So how do you see, like, this your internet operating system that you've talked about is becoming much more expansive than I think any of us would have envisaged. But how do you balance that out, do you think, with ensuring that you can protect that openness while still allowing organizations to be competitive with each other?
Yeah. Well, first off, I would say that, you know, the Internet of Things, you know, started a long time ago. You know, there are a lot of things that are networked and connected. And we have to actually think, okay, the Internet part of it is when they start, those different networks start being interconnected. You know, those early days of the Internet when it was really thought of as the network of networks, and there were all these incompatible networks that were sort of harmonized by the TCP/IP protocol. And I think we're in an early stage where there are all these networks. You know, in some ways our phone, you know, network, you know, is not truly an Internet network, but it's becoming one.
Right.
You know, our devices that are connected in various ways, our, you know, power system. At first, it's sort of a hack. You know, it's like, oh my God, I put in a Nest, and now it's somehow my, you know, my heating system is connected to the Internet. Yeah, there's a lot of people who talk about the Internet of Things as, you know, machine to machine without any human intervention, and I think that's a mistake, because one of the biggest drivers, I think, in technology are finding ways that our technology amplifies humans. It amplifies our intelligence. It amplifies our capabilities. And then the converse, the ways in which humans can amplify technology. And you think about, you know, yes, you can imagine a future in which, you know, my device running some equivalent of Google Now automatically summons the self-driving car because it knows that I'm going from, you know, come on, that's just like, yeah, maybe. But long before we get there, we have this incredible opportunity from something like Uber, which says, oh, yeah, here's an Internet of Things, your phone, the driver's phone.
Right,
you know,
right.
When we put those two things, those two connected things together, what processes could we rethink? You know, and yes, having a driver there, you know, there's a human in the loop, you know, but like, oh, wow, we could rethink package delivery, too.
Right.
You know, not just picking up people. We could rethink, you know, so to me, there's this thing of like, wow, once we have these connected devices and sensors, you know, humans can still be the actuators, but you still have an opportunity to rethink a lot of business processes. So, I think they, you know, there's also a whole side of this. You know, to me, the interesting distinction, well, first of all, let me back up a little bit. When I talked about Web 2.0, which is really just a notion for what distinguished the companies that survived the dot-com bust from the ones that didn't, you know, and it was like, hey, they were all about harnessing collective intelligence. They were all about data, not just about, you know, showing ads and so on. You know, and people would say, well, what's Web 3 then? I'd say, well, apart from the fact that it's not a version number, you know, it's going to be when collective intelligence applications are driven by sensors rather than people typing on keyboards. That's turned out to be pretty damn true.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden our devices, they know, you know, Waze is, by that definition, was a Web 3.0 application. You know, it's like, wow, you know, automatic traffic detection.
Yes.
You know, from millions of connected smartphones crying out at once that they're stuck in traffic jams.
Right.
You know, you know, obviously whatever Google plans to do with Nest will probably be, you know, have to do with energy markets and not just, you know, selling thermostats.
Right, right. It's not just going to be trophies for your heating system.
And so it'll be collective intelligence. So there's the collective intelligence aspect to all that Internet of Things. You know, once our, you know, whether it's, you know, our you know, sensors for health, you know, and all the quantified self dimension of it. You know, information about traffic is in that collective intelligence category increasingly.
Right.
Information about the economy of all kinds, distributed weather stations. You know, Ford talked about the notion that you could get very precise, you know, notion of where the rain is if every car reported when it turned on its windshield wipers.
Right, right. opens up a fascinating range of opportunities, right?
Yeah, so there's that whole aspect of you know, let's say collective intelligence. But then there's this other aspect of once you have connected devices that know things, you know, and there's data, what processes can you do differently? You know, and that's why I think Uber is such a signature app, because they've, you know, they show us the design pattern for that kind of app.
I'll be honest with you, I didn't realize that somebody out there was so equally bombastic about in their enthusiasm about Uber as my wife. We absolutely love it, and she's like a one woman marketing campaign for Uber. She absolutely loves it. But unfortunately we're out of time, Tim. We could be here for days, you know, talking about this kind of stuff. It's fascinating. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and thanks for sharing some of your insight after obviously a long career of doing this. And we'll speak to you soon.
All right, great. And we can perhaps do it again another time.
Sounds great. Thanks, Tim.
All right, thanks a lot.
So as usual, we like to take a trip down community lane and talk about some of the cool stuff that's going on in the Bad Voltage community. Just to let you know, of course, you can go and find out what's going on and join the community at community.badvoltage.org, or you can drop us emails to show@badvoltage.org. So what's been going on, Ak? Do you want to get started?
Yeah, we had an email from someone who listened to our very first show, in which we talked about Diaspora. Essentially, the reason I'm reading this out is that I get to say Diaspora and say it correctly over and over and over and over again. But this chap found out on Diaspora about Diaspora. Bad Voltage.
Sorry, I'll stop doing
that. And then
now.
Took the opportunity to complain at us for getting it wrong, because joindiaspora.com is not where you're meant to go. So if you want to find out about Diaspora, despite the brutal kicking that we gave it in show one, go to diasporafoundation.org. So thank you, Andre Janish, for letting us know. We appreciate it.
I forgot how it feels to care so little about something like that. So Jeremy.
Yeah, thanks. And we also got an email from Damon, who said, and this is regarding the selfie contest, by the way. He said, "Hi guys, love the show, blah, blah, blah. After listening to this latest show and hearing your description of the photo that won the selfie contest, I feel it imperative to point out to you that the winning entry is by definition not a selfie." Uh-oh. "Well, very cool that the subject of the photo is holding jumper cables in both hands. How could he have taken the photo? This photo was most likely taken of him by someone else and therefore should be disqualified." And then he points out that he's not pouring on the haterade. He just thinks the cable-eating guy should win because that is indeed a selfie.
Well, to be fair, the guy with the... was it Andrus who won? I forget off the top of my head.
With the jumper
cables. Maybe he's just got like... one really long monkey foot.
I don't think we're going to change the results of the competition, but that's not a totally
astute observation, I guess. But yeah,
yeah, it's actually completely fair and reasonable.
It is completely true. Yes,
I think we were distracted by the sparks and didn't realize.
yeah.
So you know, we're sorry about that. We'll do better next time.
The lot of us is easily distracted. We apologize. What do we got next, Jono?
Did you notice as well, by the way, just before going, that that two of the entries were on the same Brazzers couch?
Yes.
Yes. So,
which I thought it was fantastic. All right. So next up, we got Metanova and Dankles on the forum. They've been working on getting together a gaming server so we can have our Bad Voltage Gaming contest. The game is Team Fortress 2, which is like a first-person shooter type game by Valve. So they're working on it right now. They're hoping to have something together soon. So hopefully on the next show, we'll be able to announce the first event where we can get together and shoot each other.
And I just want to once again say kudos to Dankles, who at this point has gotten about as much airtime as Lunduk has.
Seriously, more contributions from Dankles.
Fewer contributions from Lunduk.
He's better in every possible way.
Talking about the wider Bad Voltage universe, Jono was hoping to further communitize the community with community tools, and so we put together a thing called The Matrix, which is where we're going to basically collect cool community stuff that's going on. So if you look at badvoltage.org, there's a thing called The Matrix. At the moment, it links to various different places and so on, the IRC channel and things. And we want to collect more stuff though, as things happen.
Yeah. Yeah. If you do cool stuff, like let us know. I mean, when we did this with Lug Radio, we had people were setting up, like, there was a podcast about what we talked about in Lug Radio called #LugRadio. There was the gaming clan, there was the forum, there was all kinds of stuff that people did just to have fun with each other. And we want to make sure that we can do the same thing with Bad Voltage. So if you've got cool stuff you want to do, this is the community that you can do it in, then we'll put it up on The Matrix.
Absolutely. And I also wanted to point out that Joe from the forum is actually working on a Bad Voltage Android app. So if you're an Android user and would like to, you have a feature request, or even if you want to go ahead and pitch in and help Joe, head to community.badvoltage.org, and it's one of the top threads right now. So put your feature requests in, like I said, or bug reports, anything you may have, and let us know what you think about the app.
Yeah, and the other thing as well is we've got a Bad Voltage IRC channel. So if, you know, the community forum is brilliant for obviously posting messages to, but if you want to hang out with people in real time and chat to them, then you want to check out the Bad Voltage IRC channel, which is it's #BadVoltage on the Freenode IRC network. Now that might all sound like gobbledygook to some of you, so quite easily you can go to badvoltage.org/IRC. It's linked from the Matrix page as well. And then there's a nice little embedded chat widget. So you just whack in a username and connect, and then you can go and chat to people. Obviously, like any chat channel, like how good it is dependent on if there's people in there and having a conversation. Like right now, there's like 36 people in there. And most of the people in there are based in a mixture of the US and Europe. So depending on when you connect, there'll be people hanging out. But it's a really nice vibe in there, really nice atmosphere. It's good to see that forming as well.
Yeah, the other thing... I wanted to mention, I wouldn't normally mention this, but someone set up a Bad Voltage Reddit.
Yeah.
I mean, normally I wouldn't say this was particularly exciting, but as far as I can tell, there's one thread in there, and that one thread is full of people saying that I'm funny and you guys aren't. So I'm all in favour of it.
And
so check out the Bad
Reddit has officially jumped the shark.
Check out the Bad Voltage Reddit. Go there from now on, people. I'm all fine with that. But yeah, I mean, I've got quite into Reddit over the last year or so.
I love Reddit. So it's brilliant. So what's your favorite subreddit? What's your favorite subreddit? Apart from the Bad Voltage one, obviously, that you set up.
I did not, thank you very much. Favorite, at the moment, probably Incremental Games.
What's that?
Have you played Cookie Clicker?
No, I don't play games. I'm too busy
playing Battlefield 4.
Apart from Battlefield 4, which is not a game. It's a way of life. Sorry, no.
No, and Incremental Game is, I mean, they're relatively simple things. The way Cookie Clicker works is you just sort of click on a thing and then it builds stuff up. And that's the basic concept of the whole thing. But there's a whole community around doing it, and I think it's quite interesting. So I'm reading that.
Jeremy, do you use Reddit at all?
I am not a massive Reddit user, no.
No. Oh, it's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Jeremy already has a really, really, really big forum to read. He doesn't need another one.
That's it.
I can't read all the threads on LQ, so I try not to go to Reddit.
Is LQ bigger than Reddit? Have you had Barack Obama on?
Once, yes. Yeah. I believe we're mildly smaller than a company that bought itself back from Condé Nast.
By the way, did you see that Zach Galifianakis Between Two Ferns when Obama was on there? On Funny or Die?
I heard about it, anybody, I didn't see it.
Oh, it's hilarious. Zach Galifianakis has got this interview show that he does called Between Two Ferns, which is obviously, you know, satirical. But he had Obama on there and it was comedy gold. So folks should go and check it out. Anyway, we digress. as we say, if you want to join the community, go to community.badvoltage.org and join in the fun. It's a really fun place to hang out, post interesting things there. You don't just have to join in the conversations that are already started. You can post new conversations or
absolutely.
New things, new ideas and topics and who people you should interview and whatever else. And then, of course, the ISC channel at badvoltage.org/ISC. And you can drop us email to show@badvoltage.org. There we have it, another show in the can. Big thank you to Tim O'Reilly for joining us on the show. No thank you to Brian Lungdoop for being the pathetic pikey that he is for not joining us.
No, absolutely.
And once again, a big thank to X for dropping everything he was doing. He literally dropped a box so that he could record the show with us. So we do appreciate it.
Tragically, I didn't drop a box. I dropped about 471 boxes. You should see my house right now.
You see, you don't need that fancy scale that Jeremy's got. This is, you're going to be like half the size just by moving, right?
Just by moving stuff. Moving us. No, that sounds like a very good idea. But I will use the within GS body analyzer thing to know how much how much weight I've lost.
So, another show in the can. If you want to come and join the community, obviously community.badvoltage.org is the place to be. If you want to go and hang out with people in real time, you can go in badvoltage.org/IRC. And of course, show@badvoltage.org is how you can get in touch with us, where we may or may not read your email. Probably will, though.
Next week, we're breaking down the bullshit of Lundu's excuses for why he's not on the show.
I used to love
Hopefully
that show.
Hopefully he'll be able to join us for that.
I used to love it when he was on the Linux No Action show. All right, so I guess we should wrap it up. See you next time, folks.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.